This podcast episode contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to episode 3 of The Blood Evidence. I'm your host, Stacey Metzler. When I was researching and making my calendar for weekly content, I had this one originally a little farther down the list, but as I started doing some research, I just felt compelled to share Dian Fossey's story, as the more I learned, the more I became fascinated in so many ways. Of course, the gruesome way in which she was murdered piqued my interest at first, and all the controversy that surrounded it, but what really stood out to me was how much there was this duality surrounding her regarding her as a human being, even in death. People either loved her or they hated her. I couldn't understand why people would feel so angrily toward a primatologist, zoologist, and scientist. Her life's work was devoted to preserve mountain gorillas, and she worked tirelessly to gain their acceptance and trust. She spent years, 18 in fact, prior to her death, collecting data and living a menial life out of tents in very rural areas with little provisions to conduct her research and just be with the gorillas. Those with such a huge, selfless heart toward animals are my kind of people. But the way she operated was called active conservatism, and this is defined as utilizing more aggressive, in-your-face tactics in defense of species, as opposed to the pretty common way of conservatism, which is to influence local laws and develop long-term strategies. She formed very strong bonds with her mountain gorillas, fought back hard, and because of this, she made a lot of enemies. She was one of the foremost primatologists of her time, being one of the three Leakey's angels, also humorously dubbed the Trimates, which included Jane Goodall and Berute Galdiquez. Dian's research focused on gorillas, Goodall studied chimpanzees, and Berute specialized in orangutans. So, who would possibly want to take a machete to Dian's face? Dian Fossey was born January 16, 1932 in San Francisco, California. Her parents divorced when she was really young, so it was her mother, Catherine Kidd, and stepfather, Richard Price, who raised her. She was an excellent student with good grades. She started riding horses at age 6, and as an avid horsewoman, dreamed of becoming a veterinarian. Her stepfather, Richard, was a wealthy businessman, and because of this influence, she enrolled in Marin Junior College following high school to study business. During her summer break when she was 19, Dian went to work on a ranch in Montana. Though she had to leave the ranch early due to a bout of chickenpox, this venture stirred up in her the childhood attachment and deep love for animals as she always had. She dropped out of Marin and transferred to the University of California as a pre-veterinary student. Her parents strongly disagreed with her pursuing this, so she was denied financial support from them. The physics and chemistry courses were difficult for her, so she ended up changing majors and transferring again to San Jose State College and earning a degree in occupational therapy in 1954. She supported herself through school by working as a clerk and doing laboratory work. At one point, she also took a job as a machinist in a factory to make ends meet. After graduating, she spent several months working as a hospital intern in California. By 1955, she moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and accepted a job as the director of Cosair Crippled Children's Hospital. She lived outside of the city with a family, the Henrys, and they encouraged her to tend to the farm animals. She always discussed her dreams of seeing the world and all the exotic wildlife. Though she took a safer route in college and got a, quote, stable job, her interest in animals lay just below the surface. When a friend came back from a trip to Africa with pictures to show her, Dian vowed she would go one day. There came a time when the family she was staying with, the Henrys, offered for her to go with them to Africa, but she was unable to pay to go. While they went without her, she stayed back and strategized how she could make a long voyage there work financially. In 1963, she took out a bank loan worth a full year's salary of $8,000, cashed out her life savings, and booked her a 7-week African safari. Diane first arrived in Kenya in September of 1963. The major places she ventured to were Tanzania, Congo, and Zimbabwe. A Brit hunter named John Alexander guided her. She was introduced to him by actor William Holden and owner of the now Mount Kenya Safari Club. Their first stop, and forgive me as I try my hardest to pronounce these African names, I looked them up, but I might have some problems or speak a little more slowly, so just bear with me. Their first stop was Tsavo, which is Africa's largest national park, then to the saline lake of Manyara, famous for the very large flocks of flamingos, and the Goronoro crater with abundant wildlife. One of the final stops was Old Dubai Gorge in Tanzania, and there she would meet Mary and Louis Leakey, who would change the course of her life's trajectory forever. Louis and Mary Leakey were famous anthropologists and at the time were searching for hominid fossils in Tanzania. For those unfamiliar with the term, hominids, known now as great apes, including humans, was originally coined just for humans, Homo, and their closest extinct relatives. It has now been restricted to the term hominin, which includes all members of humans after the split from the chimpanzees. So now, hominids include both. There is still a difference in opinion on that, though, between scientists among each other and laypersons. Anyway, so the Leakeys were looking for these fossils when Diane got there, and Mary introduced her to the work of Jane Goodall and how important the long-term research is of the great apes. Jane Goodall is known as the world's foremost expert on chimps. She studied the social and familial interactions of wild chimps for over 55 years. While with the Leakeys, Diane fell down a steep slope and broke her ankle. By October 16th, she was staying in a small hotel in Uganda called the Traveler's Rest. Walter Baumgartel owned the hotel and was an advocate for gorilla conservation. He introduced her to another notable couple, Joan and Alan Root. The Roots were wildlife photographers, and they allowed Diane to camp behind their camp. During these few days, Diane first encountered wild mountain gorillas. To paint a picture of mountain gorillas in the wild, males have a mean weight of 430 pounds, and when standing upright, are approximately 66 inches tall, which is about 5.5 feet tall. Females weigh half that at 220 pounds on average and are about 4.5 feet tall. Their fur is thicker and longer than any other gorilla species, which enables them to live in colder temperatures. Adult male heads have a more conical shape with protruding bony crests at the top and back of their skulls. They have dark brown eyes with a black ring around the iris. Adult males develop gray hair on their backs as they age, giving them the nickname silverbacks. They primarily move on all fours, but can climb trees to get fruit if the branches can hold their weight. They are highly social and stable. The adult males and females form very strong bonds, and they are generally shy and gentle. In 1970, Diane appeared on the cover of National Geographic magazine and said in its article, "Making Friends with Mountain Gorillas," quote, "After more than 2,000 hours of direct observation, I can account for less than 5 minutes of what might be called aggressive behavior," end quote. Today, they are unfortunately on the endangered species list, and the total population is estimated to only 1,004 left as of 2018. In her 1983 memoir titled Gorillas in the Mist, Diane wrote about this initial life-altering experience. It was their individuality combined with the shyness of their behavior that remained the most captivating impression of this first encounter with the greatest of the great apes. I left Kabara with reluctance, but with never a doubt that I would somehow return to learn more about the gorillas in the misted mountains. This was a trip of a lifetime for Diane, but like with all amazing trips, we all have to come home to face reality again. She returned to Kentucky to repay her loans. She wrote and published 3 articles in the local newspaper about her visit to Africa, and these would come in handy later. While she was working back at Kosare Children's Hospital, her head and heart remained in Africa. Her circumstances changed in the spring of 1966. Dr. Louis Leakey arrived in Louisville for a lecture tour. Diane stood in line. I can imagine how eager and excited she felt. And when she got to him, she showed him the articles she had written. Dr. Leakey was impressed, and this got his attention. The conversation started flowing, and Leakey suggested she head up a long-term field project to study the gorillas. He chose her because she was a lot like Goodall, single, focused, and with no attachments back home. Going into the field required dedication, and it takes a lot of time to collect the data. Leakey told her she would first have to remove her appendix for the trip, which she ended up doing, and then later found out he was bluffing just to see how committed she was. She was indeed committed. This proposition came 3 years after her first trip to Africa. It took another 8 months to secure enough funding for her new project. During these 8 months, she studied Swahili and audited some courses in primatology. In December 1966, she arrived in Nairobi, her dream becoming realized to return once again. On her way in the Congo, she met up with Goodall and observed her research methods. Diane was diligent in her work. She learned basic gorilla tracking using their unique identifiable nose prints from her time with Alan Root from her first trip. She mimicked their actions and grunted, which assured them she was good and kind, trustworthy. She ate what they ate and exhibited submissive behavior. She would later claim her occupational work with autistic children prepared her for this. In time, she began to gain their trust and acceptance. In 1967, Congo was experiencing political turmoil. Right off the tail end of the Congo crisis from 1960 to 1965, when Congo became independent from Belgium, the instability was almost instant under the rule of Joseph Désiré Mobutu. After a series of civil wars, it's estimated that 100,000 people died in the crisis. According to Wikipedia, the issues of federalism, ethnicity and politics, and state centralization were not resolved by the crisis and partly contributed to a decline in support for the concept of the state among Congolese people. Mobutu was strongly in favor of centralization, and one of his first acts in 1965 were to reunify provinces and abolish much of their independent legislative capacity. Subsequent loss of faith in central government is one of the reasons that the Congo had been labeled as a failed state and has contributed violence by factions advocating ethnic and localized federalism. So this was the environment that Diane was thrust into at this time. After 6 months of setting up camp in Kabara, another civil war broke out. She experienced this turmoil firsthand when, on July 9, 1967, rebel Congolese soldiers took her and her research workers to an internment camp, Rumangabo, for 2 weeks. They were initially told it was for their protection, but she would soon learn that was not the case. Bob Campbell, a trusted confidant and once lover of Diane's, a photographer for National Geographic, would one day tell reporters that though she wasn't physically abused, he hinted at sexual abuse, and that would color her perception of the African people in a negative way. She was able to escape from the camp by using bribes, convincing the soldiers that if they drove her to Uganda, they would get money and her Land Rover. She took them to Baumgartel's hotel, the Traveler's Rest. Her escorts, the soldiers from the camp, were arrested upon arrival. The U.S. Embassy advised her not to go back to the Congo. With Leakey's guidance, she restarted her study on the Rwandan side. Most people nowadays, when they hear Rwanda, they think of the massive genocide and slaughter of the Tutsi during the Rwandan Civil War in 1994. The scale of the mass murders shocked the world. Victims were murdered with machetes and rifles. An estimated 500,000 to 1 million Rwandans were killed, about 70% of the Tutsi population. 250,000 to 500,000 women were raped during the genocide. It was devastating. There are now two national holidays in Rwanda to mourn, and any denial of its happening is against the law. Known as the Land of a Thousand Hills, Diane set up camp in Rwanda. In Kabara, she lived in a 7x10-foot tent that served as her bedroom, bathroom, office, and clothes drying area. Meals were prepared in a rundown shack. She lived on tinned food and potatoes. Lots and lots of potatoes, served all kinds of ways. Once a month, she would take her Land Rover, she named Lily, and drove 2 hours to refill the pantry. While studying and living among the mountain gorillas, she also worked to fight poaching practices. Hunting had been outlawed in the 1920s, but the area was rife with corruption. With a small bribe, park conservators would turn the other way. She witnessed the aftermath of the capture of infant gorillas for zoos. Since gorillas will fight to the death to protect their young, this would result in at least 10 adult gorilla deaths per kidnapping. She became very, very attached to a gorilla she named Digit. She first encountered him in 1967 when he was about 5 years old. Tragically, he was stabbed and killed by poachers in 1977 while trying to defend his group. Diane used his death to raise more awareness about the mountain gorillas and to raise funds for anti-poaching patrols, so named the Digit Fund. She used the finances from this fund to destroy poacher traps, and in just 4 months in 1979, Diane's patrol of four African staffers destroyed 987 poacher traps in the area of her research. She was adamant that the only use of resources from the Digit Fund would be for anti-poaching activities. She helped in the arrest of several poachers, some serving life sentences, and it was documented that sometimes she would capture them and torture them. Her hatred for them growing and growing with every gorilla slaughter she would witness them do. It was described as, quote, merciless. She would whip their balls with stinging nettles. Stinging nettles, I looked up, are plants that have hollow stinging hairs that act like hypodermic needles and inject histamine, causing a stinging sensation upon contact. She would spit on them, put on masks and curse them, and stuff sleeping pills down their throats. It was once said that she took feces and injected it into a poacher, causing septicemia. She said she hated doing it and respected the poachers for being able to live in the forest, but she got into it and liked to do it and felt guilty that she did. She hated them so much. She reduced them to quivering, quaking packages of fear, little guys in rags rolling on the ground and foaming at the mouth. This growing hatred, and some say her unresolved trauma from her entrapment and supposed sexual abuse at Rumangabo, really fueled her disdain for the African people there. She began to view all locals as poachers, as enemies, or being compliant, or complicit, I should say, with the poachers. She yelled at people that worked with her, and she belittled them. She would bring fireworks from the States to scare them, and she would threaten them with witchcraft, which is horrifying to the African people. After Digit's death, she became explosive, abrasive, and completely alienated herself. This brings me to the walking contradiction that is Diane Fossey. On one hand, it's said that her mistreatment of poachers was simply alleged, that she was never actually witnessed committing any of these acts. She loved gorillas like she was their mother, a pure, selfless love that was forged by loneliness and takes a lot without giving anything back. She may have been damaged, but was driven and, quote, a victim of unlove, but with an extraordinary love that without it would be no more gorillas left in the Virungas, end quote. In an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2002, Diane was described at the end of her life, just shy of 54, as a, quote, racist alcoholic who regarded her gorillas as better than the African people who lived around them, end quote. In another account, it was said she never touched a drop of alcohol. One describes her as a loner who was disgusted with humanity and who belittled her fellow workers, orchestrated violent tortures of poachers, performed witchcraft on political enemies, and even kidnapped the children of those that threatened, quote, her gorillas. Another said she had never been sweeter as she aged and wrote many letters to dear friends. From reading about her, it seems like she might have just felt really lonely and isolated. I mean, she's in this rural, isolated area with, I mean, a few workers and the gorillas that she's observing, but she didn't really have a love life. And in those that she surrounded herself with, she didn't exactly trust. So it just seems really sad to me. She must have been really lonely. And this kind of comes out in a last letter she wrote to a good friend. She wrote, quote, "Oh, Roz, I need a friend so much. So many people are against me," end quote. The other portrays Diane as an everyday person inspired to fight for animal rights and willing to put her life on the line to confront powerful government officials, local tribal leadership, and poachers. But Diane wasn't short on enemies. While she developed these unprecedented bonds with the beasts she adored and devoted her life to, the way she alienated herself left a lot to open interpretation. Diane never got a formal education like other scientists, and that always bothered her. She left Africa in 1970 to complete work for a doctorate at the University of Cambridge in England. In 1974, she received her degree in zoology with the completion of her dissertation, The Behavior of the Mountain Gorilla. In 1980, she became a visiting associate professor at Cornell, and in 1983, published her famous book, Gorillas in the Mist. This was adapted into a hit movie in 1988 after her murder. Diane returned to Africa, and she wasn't there long when, in the early morning hours of December 7th, 1985, she was discovered in the bedroom of her cabin at the far end of the camp. She was face up near her bed, about 7 feet away from a hole cut into the wall of the cabin where her intruders entered. She had been bludgeoned to death. It was a violent scene, and very bloody. Her face was split diagonally from a machete blow. A machete, it would later be found out, that she had swiped from a poacher. There was broken glass and overturned furniture, an obvious struggle. Her belongings still remained, so robbery was not a motive. This was a planned killing, and one fueled by hatred. She was buried at her research site next to her beloved Digit and other deceased gorilla friends. Only a small crowd of acquaintances, an American minister, and a very few friends trudged in the mud up the mountain where she was laid to rest. There was, and still is to this day, a lot of controversy and speculation about who committed her murder. It is still frustratingly unsolved. But there is no shortage of theories. After the murder, her entire staff was arrested, including a tracker who she had fired after he allegedly attempted to kill Diane with a machete. All of her staff were released, except the tracker. His name, Emmanuel Rawelikana. He was later found in prison after supposedly hanging himself. But even his supposed, quote, suicide would be questioned. Diane fought aggressively against the poachers. She once wrote in a letter to her uncle in 1978, quote, "The poachers want me out of here very, very badly, and I have been told that I am next on their list," end quote. It seems obvious that poachers would be responsible, but some have blamed her death to those higher up the chain. She once wrote in a document a list of pretty important people that she had gained some intel from a poacher, that they were involved in illegal smuggling of animals and gold in Rwanda. And this could possibly have involved some government officials. So in 2001, much later, Rwandan authorities said that a man named Monsieur Zed, who had been the governor of the province during Diane's time there, had ordered her killing. He was supposedly on that document. He spent 8 years on trial for war crimes committed during the 1994 Rwandan genocide, but ultimately was never charged for her murder. Another theory is from the Rwandan people. A man who said he held the theory said he heard it from someone, quote, close to the investigation, and is this. Diane was happy with everyone except the Americans who worked for her. She made more money than them, and one day, two Zairawa were hired by two American ex-students to get rid of her. The Zairawa hired the men who worked in the camp to go through her window late one night and kill her. According to his source, two of the workers were taken in for questioning, and after several beatings, they said there were three others. The Zairawa and the Americans have not been discovered. The quote, evidence for this theory is that quote, American hair was found near the body. $1,000 cash was left in the cabin. No Rwandan would have ever passed that up. Finally, Rwandans would never kill Mzungus, a Bantu language term used to describe people of European descent. The last time a Rwandan killed a European woman was over 30 years ago, and it's because she had sacked him for stealing from her. So it had to be the work of foreigners. There was a political dimension to this theory in that Rwandans believed that AIDS was brought by the Mzungus. Actually, the virus is thought to be endemic to Rwanda, but most Rwandans who carry it are resistant and they don't even get AIDS. Another theory is that a notorious poacher named Sebahutu did it, but they found out he was in jail that December, so he couldn't have been the murderer. Other theories, though, say though he didn't technically have to commit the crime, he could have hired someone to do it. And another potential suspect was another poacher named Yavani Hatigika. She had questioned him once. He was caught skinning a bushback 50 yards from the park boundary and was brought to Diane. She wasn't allowed to touch them, so in the presence of the guard, she searched him. She knew exactly where to search too, in the lining of his clothing. In a letter she wrote in 1976, quote, I gently examined his clothing, and sewn in his sleeve was a small pouch of sumu, which means poison in Swahili, containing bits of vegetation and animal skin, all looking like vacuum cleaning debris, end quote. He refused to give her any information, so Diane kept the coveted pieces. She kind of dangled it and toyed with him a little bit. At one point, she went to go pay the guards who captured him and brought him to her, and she left the pieces on the mantle. And when he leapt to grab them, the guards grabbed him and she then took it from him. And after losing his charms, the men working for her said he would never poach again because he believed her to have black magic powers. Now that she had his sumu, he believed that though it was charmed and she now possessed it. So it was popularly theorized in America that Hatigika sent someone to break into the cabin to get back his sumu. When Diane awakened, the burglar became frightened and, grabbing the machete nearby, then killed her. Ian Redman, a scientist who went to Carisoke, her research center, to study parasites in gorillas' poop, became involved in anti-poaching activities with Diane. When he returned to the site to gather her belongings, he found a tiny Ziploc bag with the sumu. He also found a letter addressed to himself dated November 24th, detailing the incident, but was never sent. And I'm totally speculating here, but the fact that he found the Ziploc bag with the sumu kind of eliminates Hatigika, because I would imagine even if the burglar killed Diane, he would still follow through on his commitment and get the sumu to bring back to Hatigika. And since it was left, then I can't imagine that he was the culprit of her murder. Diane believed that a lot of people hated her, but one enemy was not a figment of her imagination. A mortal enemy of Diane's, a poacher named Mon Yuriko. He was a real killer, and he did hate her. One time, she had broken into his house, destroyed all of his things, and kidnapped his son. The son was well-treated, and Diane got a lot of information from him regarding poaching. But Mon Yuriko had been involved in the mutilation of Digit and shot another beloved gorilla in the group, Uncle Bert, who was the dominant silverback. However, he died in 1978. Or did he? According to Scuttlebutt, he ran away with a woman to Uganda and her people tracked him there and killed him, but there was no evidence of his death. Perhaps he came back with a vendetta to kill Diane? We may never know. We may never know for sure what exactly happened on that horrific December night in Diane's cabin. Despite the he said, she said surrounding her conservatism tactics and how she presented herself in the field and to other people, she was a phenomenal scientist, zoologist, and human being driven by a cause greater than herself. By answering her calling and protecting what she valued the most, by standing up to forces who deeply opposed her plight, she ultimately gave her life in order to preserve humans' closest relatives. May we all be so fortunate to discover a purpose with such rigor and passion, but never have to succumb to her fate at the end. In her final journal entry, she wrote, "When you realize the value of all life, you dwell less on what is past and concentrate on the preservation of the future." That's it for episode 3 of The Blood Evidence. I am now live on Anchor, Spotify, and iTunes. If you enjoy the show, please hit the subscribe and follow button so you can get instant access as they come out weekly. Next week, I'll be telling the story of Catherine Foggy, a psychologist who was stabbed to death with a meat cleaver by a schizophrenic patient in a robbery gone wrong. Until then, lock your doors and stay safe.
I'm Carl Farouf from Seven Summits Africa, and we've just come down from Mount Kirisimbi. And then on your way down, compost and Diane Fuzzy's grave. And Emmanuel will tell us a bit more.
This is Diane Fuzzy's grave, very important lady who gave her life to these remaining mountain gorillas. So for sure, she had to give her life so we can still have them. She had been here in 1967. She was passed away in 1985 by unknown people, and she was a single lady. She didn't have an husband or a baby, but I'm sure she had many silverbacks and many babies, which you cannot forget to talk about Digit and Titus, whom rises after killing his father, his brothers, and everybody, and then first take care of that boy until he became a good silverback, where you can see with a gorilla king. So. She did a good job with the communities, because the center she started, it's now had many people, and now many researchers are coming, which help us to identify how to know what we need to do for the gorillas, and it help us to know more about these mountain gorillas.
And so because of her work, then the numbers have increased. We still have gorillas.
Yeah, that's true. When she started to work, the number of the gorillas was decreasing, increasingly, you cannot believe. Where the number of the gorillas was coming from 450 and nearly 460 up to 250. So, but we are so glad that now we have about 880. That census we have 2010. Now we have 7 years. We are ready to do another census. And especially in Rwanda, we have naming ceremony every year.
Yeah.
If you remember, this year we named 19 baby gorillas. The previous year we named 22. The other we...